that is the nature of recruitment. You know, if you're fazed by objections or setbacks, then you're never going to get anywhere. And that's just a thing in life, I think, as well. So you can't take sort of umbrage with it. You can't take it personally, and you have to move forward from it.
Welcome to the Resilient Recruiter Podcast. I'm your host, Mark Whitby. Today, we're joined by Stuart Barnes.
In our, you know, in the first year on our permanent division, we did probably about just over £500,000, largely driven by myself. And then we got the contract business up and running. And I think we did about 250,000 of invoiced revenue in contracts in the first year.
Stuart has over 15 years experience in the recruitment industry, working across three continents, focusing on the energy sector. Having successfully scaled the recruitment business from 15 to 60 people while leading both the permanent and client services divisions, in 2022, he launched Navitas Recruitment Group with the vision to be the world's leading resourcing partner for talent in the renewable and clean energy sectors.
I remember calling up this SVP. He never spoke to him before. And he basically just told me to piss off. I put the phone down and I just sat there in my living room, totally silent. And I did actually say to myself, why are you doing this? And I actually had a tear in my eye because I was a little bit sort of thinking to myself, you know, this is hard.
Stuart, welcome. Thank you so much for doing this.
No, I really appreciate it, Mark, and thanks for reaching out and giving me the opportunity to discuss Navitas and speak with yourself
Absolutely.
Today.
Yeah, no, it's super cool what you guys are doing, so I'm excited to dive into that and learn from you. So just briefly, I'd love to hear your origin story. How did you wind up in recruitment?
Like many people, fell into it 2010, just after the sort of financial crash. Interviewed with S3. I didn't know much about who the movers and shakers were in recruitment at the time. Secured a job within a couple of days there and sort of went through the classic S3 training and worked my way up. Was lucky enough, as you mentioned, to get two international transfers, one to Perth, Australia in 2012, and then one to Houston, Texas in 2015. So spent, I think it was about 7 or 8 years in S3. Really enjoyed the time there. It's a terrific grounding. A lot of founders have come out of that, you know, organization and done exceptionally well. And it just gives you a really good starting point in your recruitment career. And then transitioned, as you said, into a UK-based company, Pangea, because moved back to London. Worked with the CEO, Sanjay, there. We grew that. As you mentioned, I think when I joined, it was about 15 of us, grew it to sort of 60 heads. They've now got multiple offices in the energy sector. And then I was actually approached while I was there by venture capital that wanted to set up a renewables energy business. And so that's what we've been doing since, February 2022.
Amazing. All right. So definitely want to dive into this business that you've launched, Navitas, and hear that story because that's most recent and most relevant. But just before we do that, like, what's cool about your early experience, like getting to work in Perth, Australia, and then Houston, Texas? What was that like as a British recruiter going abroad, you know, working in different countries? And what do you think that has added or brought to, you know, your success in your current venture?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's quite a unique skill set to have worked in Australia and then the US because they're very different recruitment markets. Having come from the UK, which is pretty challenging and tough, and, you know, negotiating on rates and such like, the salaries in the US and Australia are significantly higher. And there's a slightly different way of doing business. I see many a podcast that discusses the nuances and differences between a UK and a US market. And it's all true in the sense that they value recruitment as a skill set and as a job, I think, a lot higher. They see headhunting as a profession versus not. So there's always a value add there due to how candidate short the market is. So you learn a lot around being adaptable, understanding different cultures, working with different people from different backgrounds, you know, the UK traditional way of hiring people is different maybe to the US, or when you're hiring into Australia, that's internally. And then externally, I think, you know, the markets in the US and Australia are very, very different and present different challenges. So overall, you become very well-rounded. I didn't take the sort of classic, I'm a vertical market specialist in X market and did that for like 8 years and build a lot of money. I was moving between different markets, setting different markets up because I lived overseas. So that really is sort of my skill set versus being one market specific and doing that for a good period of time.
So that's cool. So not only the adaptability, but that actually gave you an opportunity to, you know, open markets, start new divisions, you know, new businesses. And that's a quite a unique and important skill set, especially for an entrepreneur. So let's talk about, you mentioned, I think when we last caught up, you mentioned that you had scaled the business from zero to 2.65 million net fee income in 2.5 years. Could you tell that story?
Yeah. So we started Navitas as a business in February 2022, although we didn't start physically trading for about 3 months. There's a lot to set up when you start a recruitment business, and you don't really think about it at first, but you have to make sure that when you go out to the market, you know, you've got a website of some description. People want to see that you're actually real. You need a platform, a CRM, and you need to make sure you've got sort of the process and back office support, how you're going to invoice placements, all these sort of things. So there's a good period of time that is done to set the business up. So then we physically started trading, May 2022. But our financial year runs September to August. So we had a small period where we sort of got up and running. But our second year, we finished with that sort of net fee income. The way we were able to grow quickly is we focused on high yielding markets and a balanced portfolio between permanent and contract. So our company has about 40% permanent, 60% contract. The first year was largely US permanent renewables, obviously focused market income, because, you know, quicker deal cycles, could invoice quickly, that generated cash. So I think in the first year on our permanent division, we did probably about just over £500,000 between sort of two or three of us, and the two or three joined later on in the year. So they probably only had about 3 or 4 months. So it was largely driven by myself. And then we got the contract business up and running, and I think we did about 250,000 of invoiced revenue in contract in the first year. That's led by my partner Josh, who's a director of contract there, and the aim was to have a balanced sort of portfolio of permanent and contract, so we could have reoccurring revenue from a contract perspective, and we could generate cash flow quickly with the US permanent. And then, you know, we sort of flipped that into the second year, where the contract book started really gaining, and we were able to add headcount quickly on perm in the right markets. And built quite a few strong clients, which meant people could come in and hit the ground running from that perspective. So that then enabled us to grow to about 20 headcount, just over 20 headcount in the second year.
Wow.
Yeah.
I've got so many questions. So like the rapid growth is fascinating. I think we should probably take a step back. So this is a venture capital backed business, right? So going in, I think what's unique about this situation, you must have, I'm guessing you already knew, like, we're scaling, like from day one, you knew that was what you wanted to do, and you had some kind of a game plan. So before we get into the specifics of, like, you know, increasing headcount, getting the client base going, all that stuff, what was the vision when you launched the business, and how did that affect decision making in terms of what you did and in what order?
We started the business in the renewable sector. I'd done a little bit of the renewable sector in the last role, and it got ever increasing. But like any recruitment market, you need to find a market. You're going to start something where there's a genuine demand for good talent, and there's a gap in the market. And I think in 2022, what we were seeing is that the renewable sector was trying to grow very quickly, but it didn't have the talent to sustain the growth. So talent was almost like a barrier in one way, because these companies, certainly in the US, which is a little bit behind Europe, they were trying to hit their goals. A lot of them are privately backed. There's a lot of private equity funding and money. Obviously, they want their returns. So they were trying to hit their goals. But the only way they can do that is by hiring the top talent in the market, because they need the knowledge, the experience to be able to do that. And that talent shortage meant that we were able to capitalize on the funding and development of these companies to source and find candidates. And companies were willing to pay, you know, significant amount of money to hire these people. So I think whenever you start any type of sort of business, you need that sort of niche focus, but also there needs to be a reason behind sort of what you're doing. And then second to that, we're obviously very passionate about facilitating the energy transition. I, in previous roles, have done more fossil fuel or oil generation, but moved across to renewables probably about 2017, 2018. And it's a market that's very fascinating. Obviously, the planet needs renewables. I think, you know, it's not 100% renewables, but it needs a mix between renewables. And there's still a place for oil and gas and fossil fuels, et cetera. But the scale of what companies want to do, especially with data centers and AI and the technology that's coming on board, renewables has to be a massive part of that. And I think it's quite an indispensable thing that needs to grow. And so we're sort of passionate about placing people that are going to assist the transition of this. And I think when you're doing something that you're passionate about, and then as I come back to the original point that there's a market there for it and there's a client demand there for it, I think it's quite a compelling sort of place to start a business.
Absolutely. Okay, I'm loving this. So first of all, you're finding the intersection between where there's strong client demand in the marketplace for talent and then something that you're personally passionate about. That's got to be an explosive combination, right? Because,
yeah,
you know, then everything's lining up. So that makes total sense. So then you'd obviously select, you'd done the research and identified, okay, this is the part of the market that we want to focus on because of the potential and the funding and, you know, that, I mean, obviously it's needed by our planet to move in this direction. So there's a lot of forces that are pushing us in this direction anyway. So we're just basically riding that. And it's something that we also believe in. Where do you go from there in terms of like, so what was your vision in terms of like the, how quickly you wanted to scale and where you eventually wanted to get to?
Yeah, I sat down initially and part of the process with the VC investors was we wanted to scale the business pretty aggressively, and there was a 5-year plan that was sort of mapped out with headcount growth, EBITDA, NFI, and that was year on year. And it was very aggressive, and it was done sort of, this is like utopia. This is like, if we do this, we've absolutely smashed it, right? Knowing probably that isn't likely to happen, but if you don't reach for the stars, you know, you don't you're not going to get as high as you would normally do, right? So we sort of set that out, and I think the first 2 years we were on track for it. We were definitely on track for it, and yeah, that was something that we set out to do. We used something what we call the ingredients. We have 16 pillars, which I won't go into every one because we'll be here all day, but we have 16 pillars of how we operate the business. It's like our operator's mandate. Whenever we do something new, we refer back to our ingredients. So this is stuff like, you know, market strategy, how we hire, you know, when we enter new markets, our values, our hiring process internally, these sort of things, which sort of govern how we, you know, the principles, how we operate the business. And we stay sort of true to those. But I think, if anything, I think in hindsight, we probably scaled a little bit too quickly in hindsight. If I reflect back now, I think we got to a point where we got to, I don't know, 15, 16 mark, and we were doing extremely well. And I think we probably, yeah, in hindsight, probably scaled too quickly, and that's then the challenge of what happens is the business that you have, the culture and everything, the when you're at 10 to 15, you know, it's controllable. When you're going to sort of 25, 26, it starts becoming a, you know, a slightly different business at that point, from that perspective.
Okay, awesome. So you had this 5-year vision and the 16 pillars. The vision was quite aggressive, but you know, that's you're aiming for the stars. At least you'll hit the moon, right? That's the mindset. So then what happened next? Like that first year you described, like there's a core team. So nucleus, there's yourself and a couple of key people, and you hit what, 500K did you say in that first year? Or
so if I take the first full financial year that we did, so the May to sort of August, which is like 4 months, if you put that aside, so if we go September to August, the first year that we filed 1.3 million NFI.
That's a strong first year. So 1.3 million, is that, are we talking pounds or dollars?
Pounds. Yeah, it's all pounds.
Okay. By the way, terminology, just not everyone knows this term. So NFI, net fee income.
Yeah.
I typically just say GP.
Sure. Yeah, GP.
Or some people say net margin. It's basically your permanent billings plus your contract billings minus whatever the payroll costs or costs of paying your contractors, right? So it's the profit from the temp side and then the billings from the perm side together. Gotcha. So 1.3 million in the first full financial year is fantastic.
Yeah, and then we doubled it in the second one. That's 2.65.
So okay, how did you just hit the ground running and explode so quickly? What were the kind of key, you mentioned the word ingredients earlier there, but what were those key ingredients that allowed you to do that?
Personally, myself, I was obsessed with performing sort of at the highest level in what I thought I could bill. I'd been off billing tools as such for probably 4 or 5 years. So there's always a bit of a case where you reflect on, oh, can I do this? And that was interesting at the start. But
Hold on, let me ask about this. First of all, I love the word obsession. My wife tells me I'm obsessed all the time. Like, I think, I mean, there's probably a bad side to that. But overall, I think you can't really achieve anything remarkable without being a little bit obsessed, right? And so you sort of skimmed over, but I'd love to hear about the fears that you had when you launched this, because you had been in a senior leadership role running big teams, right? But then any startup business, you have to just roll up your sleeves and, you know, get clients and make placements and generate revenue yourself, right? I think it would be naive to think you could start a business and have everybody else doing that kind of work from day one. So you, like, did you have a sense of imposter syndrome or anxiety? Like, can I still do this? Am I still going to be, you know, I was good at it, but I haven't done it for a while. Talk me through where was your head at around that?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. When I accepted the role and moved forward with it, I said to my wife, "Can I do this?" She was like, "Yeah, go for it. Go, yeah, do it." Because it was going to involve longer hours, etc. But until you get day one and you're in the role, you can't really fully prepare yourself for it. And I would say, Mark, like for the first 6 months, I woke up every day with this, not impending doom, but can I do this? And I was lucky enough to do a deal within 5 weeks. And I was lucky enough, I think I'd build up about 100K in the first 3 or 4 months. So I was up and running pretty quickly. But even then, because I wanted to perform at such a high level, and I put a lot of hours into it, you know, 60-hour weeks or whatever. And it was a case of it literally takes over your life. And that's where I say about the obsession, it becomes ever engrossing. And it didn't quite get to the point where it was problematic with other things in my life, but it was a case where I'd probably set the boundaries early with people that I was, you know, close to, or I loved, that you know, this was going to be the case, that I'm going to have to put everything into this. And it allowed us to move quickly in the business by being able to generate the revenue quickly. But I you know, the first month, I mean, I still remember it now. There's two instances where I look back and go, wow, that was the start of it all. So the first one was, I was working out of my house still because we were waiting to get our office, which wasn't going to be going live for another couple of weeks. So I remember it. I was on a Friday. It's about 6 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, sort of evening. And I was BDing, trying to pull jobs. I'd pulled a couple of jobs initially, and I was just BDing. I remember calling up this SVP company, never spoke to him before. And he basically just told me to piss off. And I put the phone down and I just sat there in my living room, totally silent, obviously, because it was quiet. And I just sort of looked around and I did actually say to myself, why are you doing this? A little bit to myself. And I actually had a tear in my eye, because I was a little bit sort of thinking to myself, you know, this is hard. This is, you know, and then obviously, you know, you sort yourself out a couple of minutes later, you go, what are you doing? So to speak. So that was the first one. That was about 2 weeks in. Because I'd trained people about objection handling, and I'd just done probably one of the worst sales calls ever. I mean, I just literally just, you know, capitulated after this guy told me to get lost, basically. So that was quite interesting. And then the second one, I was lucky enough, as I said, to do a deal within 5 weeks, which was great. But the same client that I placed with, I'd spoken to a candidate about the same role on a Friday. I think this is a couple of Fridays later. And I spoke to the candidate, got his resume. He was a good fit for this role that I was working on. And I then got a call from the client that they wanted to offer my candidate. So I totally forgot about this candidate that I'd just qualified for the role. Bearing in mind, in the US market, you know, there's not a massive amount of candidates. So it's not like you're on the phone qualifying people all the time. I totally forgot about this because I got this call from the client saying, yeah, we want to offer your candidate. I was like, oh, brilliant. No. Anyway, a week, about 3 or 4 days goes by, and then it suddenly twigs that I haven't sent this candidate over to the client. Anyway, he gets a job with the client, but for another agency, because I just didn't send him over. Yeah. So
gutted. That's
so, yeah.
You must have just been kicking yourself. That's like,
yeah,
the worst feeling, right? That's like the worst feeling. Your candidate gets a job, but you don't get the credit.
Yeah. And the funny thing was, when I called the candidate up a bit later the week, and after he said he'd been submitted, he thought it was someone else from the same Navitas that had spoken to him. But it was another. Anyway, it was one of those moments where I was sort of, I was like, I have to sort this out. But just very basic errors. Just from being out of practice, I guess, and not really applying it properly. But I think at the start, those were the things. And as And as the business grew, because we had, there was two of us initially, then another two quite quickly after that. But as it grew to sort of 6, 7, 8, that's when I breathed a little bit more and was like, okay, we're in a good upward trajectory here, and I feel good about this now, and I feel that I can do it. So that imposter syndrome probably lasted, I'd probably say, a good 4 or 5 months before it started releasing itself a little bit, and I was like, okay, we're in a good moment now.
Stuart, thank you so much for sharing that, the inner side of this, because we all experience that, no matter how successful you are, no matter how experienced you are, right, is like doubting yourself or questioning, am I doing the right thing? Or, you know, so it's really refreshing to hear that, you know, you went through that as well, but also the fact that you can still mess up on a BD call, right? That's also good for people to hear, because, and yet you're super successful and you've built a really, a really fast growing, successful firm, because you don't have to be perfect, but if you do have to be all in. If you're committed and you're like really going for it, then you are still going to mess up. You know, you're going to make mistakes. But that doesn't define you, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think you've hit the nail on the head there. And I say to a lot of people that join our business or interview at entry level, that it is about making mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, you can't grow and you can't move forward, because usually if you make a mistake, you've got outside your comfort zone. And if you get outside your comfort zone, it means you're a bit uncomfortable. But if you learn to be, I always say, if you learn to be comfortable when you're uncomfortable, that's how you grow. And if you can grow and learn, that's how you're going to become a better recruiter versus the person that procrastinates or doesn't pick the phone up or doesn't do that call. And the ironic thing about that story, about the SVP that I called, 6 months later, one of my team got a response on a job advert from that person who got let go from his company. So I kind of had a little chuckle to myself, because I thought, 6 months ago you were telling me to get lost, and now we're
that's
helping you
classic,
find a job,
isn't it? Exactly, it's funny, isn't it? And I think I saw a post about this on LinkedIn recently that someone was like, you know, that client was rude to me, and so doesn't he, like, he's potentially burning bridges, right? Where You're reaching out to someone to try and help, ultimately help them. Yeah, it helps us as well, right? But you're reaching out to them in good faith with, like, we could potentially bring value to your business, right? And if they, now, of course, everyone's busy and, you know, whatever, but it doesn't hurt. Like, being polite doesn't cost you anything, right? So why would you be like rude to somebody who's just trying to do their job? But anyway, potentially burning a bridge. And then, like, as you say, 6 months later, we probably can all think of examples of this, right? Suddenly that person does want to talk to you, and it's because they, you know, are looking for a job. What's your mindset around that? Do you think, you know, once bitten, twice shy, or do you just think, well, you know, it's an opportunity, let's see if we can help them?
No, it's definitely the latter. I think, you know, I reflect on that moment and go, maybe he was having that person was having a bad day. I caught him at the wrong time. You know, that is the nature of recruitment. You know, if you're fazed by objections or setbacks, then you're never going to get anywhere. And that's just a thing in life, I think, as well. So you can't take sort of umbrage with it. You can't take it personally, and you have to move forward from it. And that's the best way to do it.
Let's talk about BD, because I think we're in a moment where, look, we both know that recruiters and even recruitment business owners, like, the business development should never, ever stop. But the reality is, when times are great and you're inundated with projects and searches, it's human nature that the vast majority of people take their foot off the gas. They don't do as, they're not as active. They're not proactive. They more go into delivery mode. And inevitably that comes back to bite you. And I think that's where we are right now. So the folks who like weren't as consistent, or even, I mean, it depends on the market, which market you're in. We're seeing some recruiters who are fantastic at business development and marketing still finding it tough at the moment. So what's your approach to BD and how are you guys winning work?
It's a great, really good question. I think we're fully 360 as a model. So I think from that, you know, you can surmise that we are very, you know, pro business development and expect everyone to have that skill set. A bit like, you know, you're supposed to have your five fruit a day or whatever. An hour of BD a day is expected in the business. And we do power hours with the whole business. So it's not one of these situations where one person's BD and another person's not. I think you want to reduce the barriers for people to, you know, procrastinate around, should I do the BD activity? So unless there's like a business critical situation, everyone's expected on that power hour to business develop, and we gamify it because we have competitions, and we find that generally that gets the sort of input required of business development, i.e. connecting with as many hiring managers as possible, you know, in your niche to discuss, you know, our services and the candidates that we represent. So I think that's kind of in our sort of DNA that, you know, if you join Navitas, you're 360 and you're expected to BD fundamentally. Yeah.
So I like the 1 hour a day. It's like your five portions of fruit and veg a day. So that's a great philosophy. So that's like your minimum expectation. Everyone is doing at least an hour of business development a day, but you've made it more fun because we're doing it together, right? And you're not the only person on the phone. You're all doing it at the same time, which just creates more camaraderie and more, you know, it just feels a lot nicer if you're doing it that way. What about the strategy though? Like what have you guys found to be the most effective forms of business development? You know, I heard you using an S3 term, pulling jobs earlier. What's like, what are your go-to methods for BD?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So I think on the contract side of things, we are largely focused around the typical sort of structure of every manager that should be added to the CRM on contract should be someone that hires contractors. And there should be a link to that manager to understand the types of profile that they would hire. And then I think that there's sort of, I like to have like three buckets in terms of business development. So I think there's like your initial leads, so short-term wins. So this would be hot leads in the market where, you know, a company's hiring and there's a call to action on that. And there's a specific sort of cadence follow-up that we use on our hot leads or you know, where we follow up on that. Then there's like the key account side of it, which is pretty self-explanatory, is basically massaging key accounts and keeping front and center with companies we've got terms with, so that when they are releasing jobs to an agency where, you know, you're Navitas are being considered. And then I think there is the final step of it, which is more the medium term, long term relationship building, which I think is the area that people struggle with the most. So I think that is identifying. I mean, the number I look at is 300. So I say to everyone, 300 managers. You need 300 hiring managers in your database as a minimum. And your aim is to identify out of those 300. Who are going to be the medium to long-term hirers in your market? And obviously, there's a number of questions you can ask on a BD call to ascertain that in the first BD call. but it's am I going to stay in contact with this person on a monthly basis? And typically, I think it's what, 6 to 8 times that they say don't they, before people buy sometimes. I think people give up before then.
Yeah.
So my philosophy on it is, and I say to everyone, is these 300 managers will hire at least one person this year. So if you take that, 300 people are going to hire someone in their team. Are they going to hire it through you, another agency, directly or through referrals or some different way? But if they are going to hire it through an agency, then we need to be sort of front and center of that. And therefore, we need to, you know, maintain that relationship with them. And that involves calling them up every month, following up on previous conversations, talking about industry news, doing things like just calling them up about a candidate that you're working with at the moment, and just engaging them so that their sort of, you know, brain functions when they get a job. If they think of an agency, they're going to go to your agency first of all. And I think that's, in this day and age, the generation of today like things immediately. They like that, you know, I refer to it as sort of the Klarna culture, where I can pretty much buy most things straight away. You know, when I started in recruitment, if I wanted to buy a nice suit, because you wore suits to work then, you would have to physically have the money in your bank account to go and do that. Now you can just stick it on Klarna and get it, right? So that there is that, in this day and age, you can get things quicker and people want things quicker, but building relationships isn't going to happen straight away. And that's about maintaining, you know, a cadence over a number of months, six to 8 months to a year, to then, you know, build that relationship, because then the client will think, oh, okay, this person is following up me and is repeatedly in my line of vision. So yeah, I will naturally, if I'm looking to hire, I will go to them. So that's the way I would see BD and how we do the BD strategy. And I look for everyone to have those three buckets, you know, applying a certain percentage of their time in BD to each of those areas.
This is brilliant. Thanks for sharing that, Stuart. I think really useful. So they need a minimum of 300 hiring managers that they have added to the database, and they're reaching out to them monthly. Is that the idea? So that you mentioned the 6 to 8 touch points. So over the course of 6 to 12 months, hopefully they're going to start to get some opportunities with those hiring managers. And then over time, that can really snowball. And then those turn into the key accounts that then you're trying to maximize. And is it mainly just a telephone outreach, or what channels are you using in order to do your business development?
Yeah, I think this is obviously becoming more and more prominent that, you know, these days. Yeah, the telephone is number one, always is. But I think Microsoft Teams for video meetings. So we'll just put Microsoft Teams invites into people's diaries. So just put it straight in a diary. I'd say at least 50% will accept it, and then you just jump on a meeting with them.
Let's talk about this, because this is a controversial one, Stuart. And I've seen various LinkedIn posts about, like, if one more person like invites me to a, you know, to a Teams or a Google meeting or a Zoom meeting unsolicited, then, you know, so what's your philosophy on that, and what's the success rate that you're finding?
So that's the key to it. You wouldn't do it unsolicited. I think unsolicited is creating starting the relationship off not in the right way. I think as long as there's been a BD call, then I think at that point it's fine to do. But I wouldn't, unless obviously it's been sort of discussed or set up. But yeah, we wouldn't do it unsolicited, but we do use that a lot as a call to action. So, you know, in general, on processes or anything like that, we'll just send a Teams meeting to whoever it is. And the great thing about that is you'll get a response. So if I just email a hiring manager asking for something, i.e. feedback or decision or, you know, some advice on something, they don't have to reply to that. But for whatever reason, if you stick a diary invite, a Teams meeting in for later that day or tomorrow with, I don't know, feedback on resumes, if they don't accept it, they will action it.
Okay, so I totally get it if you're in process, right? That makes a lot of sense. But explain to me how you would use it in a BD context in a way that that the client is going to accept.
So that would be typically you've spoke to them at least once,
okay,
maybe a couple of times, and you want to get face-to-face contact with them. Because obviously, as we know, if you get face-to-face contact with someone, you can build a better relationship with it.
Yes.
So I think it's taking the relationship to the next level.
Okay.
And because maybe you've done a couple of phone calls with them, then that's a good opportunity to be able to do that. And because you've spoke with them a couple of times and they know who you are, they'll either accept it, or if they don't accept it, they'll suggest, let's catch up, in 2 months or whatever. And largely people are pretty receptive to it. We don't really have massive kickback I can't remember anybody that's said to us, stop, as you said there. So I think maybe the context of how people are using it, if you just send it out the blue and you've not spoke to the person before, I think that's probably where you might run into some issues.
That makes sense. I can see it being super useful where, like, often one of the outcomes, if you're calling someone and they don't have an immediate need, then, different possible outcomes. You might ask for referrals or, more information about the business or future plans. But ultimately, you're probably going to ask to, like, you're going to get some kind of a commitment to call them back again, right? So I think in that context, it makes a lot of sense because, if they say, oh, call me in 3 months, right? And you're like, okay, well, why don't we talk? And then you're going to propose an earlier time than that, because 3 months, anything can happen, right? That's too far.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're going to try and negotiate a sooner check-in. But coming off that call, I can totally see it making sense to send them the invite with a specific time because it's fresh in their mind and but would there be a situation where you would just send it out of the blue to someone who you had spoken to in the past or?
Yeah. If we want to get hold of someone, 100%.
Okay.
Yeah, I think so.
So in other words, you're calling, but they're not, you haven't been able to reach them. Let's just send them the calendar invite. Is that the idea? Or
yeah, I think if you're on a monthly cadence with someone, and the reason why we do monthly, Mark, is, as you said, things can change quite quickly. Hiring processes take 4 to 6 weeks. If you're not following up with someone that regularly, they could easily start a process, probably hired someone by the time you next catch up with them, and the previous time you spoke with them, they might not be hiring at all. But certainly in the US market, where it's 2 week notice, if someone hands a notice in and they need to replace that person quickly, then off they go, so to speak. So I think, yeah, that's sort of how we would do things, and I think that's also a testament to, if people do accept that, what's the quality of your first calls been like? Because if they sort of go, who are you? Then obviously they don't remember the calls or whatever. So I think that's what we try and get across.
Fantastic. So it's phone first, trying to get FaceTime with people. What else is in your toolkit?
So LinkedIn, obviously, I think, commenting and connecting with people sort of via LinkedIn, I think is certainly the case. We're fairly, we don't have a massive tech stack or anything like that. AI and these sort of things is not something, because of the deal sizes and what the market we do, I like to try and make sure that people are doing it themselves to a certain extent, their follow up and emailing and things like that. Face to face, we'll get out to conferences, exhibitions. Typically, we try and group those. So, the contract team have been to Copenhagen and Bilbao for wing conferences. The US team have been to Las Vegas and Anaheim, Los Angeles, for renewable exhibitions. So that's like an annual, that'd be like an annual thing, I would say.
Fantastic. Just, yeah. A lot of our clients are really embracing in-person conferences these days and finding they're getting good traction from that. I think it's what you said earlier. It's in-person, face-to-face with clients. You can't really beat that. I do think I would challenge your thinking around the potential for automation and that kind of thing to save time. Maybe that's something we can talk about offline, because I agree, like phone first, in-person or virtual in-person, that's like the foundation. But I think there is a lot more that we can leverage technology in order to, regardless of deal size, to amplify the reach of each of your consultants. But so look, thank you for sharing your BD strategies, because the people love the like really tactical stuff that you shared. This is going to be a popular episode already, Stuart, because you've already given so much value. Keep in mind also that, so initially when you were starting the business, you're working the US market, but from London, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, a lot of late nights.
Yeah, I bet. So, at this stage, what size is the team now?
So we got to 12 in the first year. I think we just touched 12 people in the first year, which was probably about 60% contract, 40% permanent. So I'd gone from sort of a glorified principal consultant, as I like to say, when I first started the business, maybe up to like a team leader or something. By, you know, and the same with Josh. So we were really full speed concentrating on sales related stuff. Not as much strategy stuff, just full on with sales and just in the trenches basically. And the great thing about that is it just gives sort of a legacy of, hey, I've been doing what you've done. I've done it. You know, got the medals to show it, so to speak. And I think as a founder, you get a lot more respect, as you said at the start. Very difficult to start a business and not lead from the front. I think any good team or anything needs that as a starting point.
100%. And plus, you know, you need cash and sales. I mean, really, this is a sales business, right? And so that's got to happen as a priority. One of our clients is a guy called Paul Taff. He's been on the podcast a couple of times. He was an ex private equity guy. Well, first he was a CFO, then he was private equity, and then now he recruits CFOs. And he told me, like, because I asked him about KPIs, he said, "Mark, my number one KPI is how much money is in the bank." That's like, you know, because if you don't have money in the bank, then nothing else matters, right? So you got to 12 people by the end of year one. You were billing manager, team leader sort of role. Where are we at now?
Yeah. So we grew to year two to 25 people with 2.6, which was the end of August.
Okay.
2024, so last year. So yeah, we were at sort of absolutely flying at that point.
That's incredible. That is just an incredible trajectory.
Yeah, we were, and I think, as I said just a little bit earlier, I think we probably scaled a little bit too quick. I'd then gone off the billing at that point, because we operationally and strategically, I just didn't have the time.
Yes.
To generate revenue.
Just on that, what was the point at which you felt confident that, okay, I can come off a desk in order to grow faster and help everyone else to perform better?
It was when, as I was doing the permanent revenue, was our contract book was at a point where that was month in, month out generating profit, and that was profitable. And then our permanent business didn't require me chipping in with deals. So if you fit in the first 12 months, I did about a third of the revenue.
Yeah.
In the first 12 months of the business. By the second year, I'd done less, I'd think about 5% of the revenue.
Fantastic. Okay.
Which then meant that, you know, realistically, I was just running the business at that point, and we were able to scale and develop it. And then we came into this financial year with lofty goals, wanting to, you know, grow even further. And the US renewable space got hit pretty hard with the election. So in the months leading up to the election, there was a bit of uncertainty. A lot of clients were sort of, let's just wait and see what happens with the election. So we had a little bit of that before the election. And then after the election, once the result, then it was a case of, oh, let's see how things go over the next couple of months. You had the tariff situation. That sorted itself out a little bit. But what it did mean is we had to really double down and focus on what we were doing as a business, because we did endure a little bit of pain in that period of time. And then one of our biggest contract clients had some problems, and therefore we lost a few contractors with them. So it's a bit of a double whammy at the same time. And it certainly was probably the most challenging period since we started the business, which meant, you know, things were just, we were looked at a lot more tightly, you know, through these external factors that had happened. And I think we've come out of it now, and I think probably as a business we're going to be a lot better for it, because you tighten everything up operationally and strategically, and all your sales processes and things like that. And it was a good learning curve, I think. But I think through the backing that we have from our venture capital partner, who were, you know, sort of brilliant through that period of time, it's probably made us a better business coming out of that period of time.
So I'd love to drill down on this a little more, because there's definitely been a correction in a lot of markets. And I mean, renewables being one, I think I read, you'll correct me if I'm wrong, but I think it was BP who have massively rolled back a lot of their renewable, like the investment they're planning on making in green energy, they've like scrapped because A, their share price compared to their competitors, you know, was low, and they've seems like they've doubled down more on fossil fuels. But I don't want to get into politics here, but it's pretty obvious that the current administration in the US doesn't really care about, you know, hitting targets for reducing emissions and that kind of stuff, right? So when you've put your whole focus, like you're placing a big bet on renewables, right? You that's what you guys specialize in. And look, in the long term, obviously that's the way that things are going to go, and it's a good bet, but it could be volatile, right? And what did you learn, and what specific changes did you make once you realized that you maybe overextended and then, you know, your profits went down?
Yeah, I think we'd hired for a continuation of the 2024-2023. So I think when you're hiring, you know, a lot of people, they obviously take time to get up and running. And when there's a challenge in the market, you know, that's a problem. So that meant that, you know, there was a bit of a sharpening of the sword there to ensure that the business was in the best sort of position moving forward.
What does that really mean, sharpening the sword though? Like what?
I think there was a higher expectation of what people could deliver and what everything, you know, when you're doing well, it's always the case that, you know, certain periods of time aren't sort of as, you know, looked at as tightly as possible. But when there's challenges in the market, you're looking to extract literally everything from everywhere. And if someone's not showing the right values. Some of the time, you know, it just means that I think everything just gets looked at in a lot more scrutiny. And I think that means that you create better operational efficiency moving forward. And so you take those practices from tougher times. And you know, I think if you look at some of the, I know S3, when they had the financial crash, they took a lot from that financial crash, pivoted and became, you know, even bigger, better and bigger business. And there's lots of examples, isn't there, out there. And I think you really do learn a lot about yourself, business, and the people you work with when times are a little bit more challenging. Because we'd had a really exciting and great run, and you know, when you're owning and running and growing a business, it's never going to be perfect all the time, and there's always going to be challenges there. It's just how you sort of go about and learn from those. So we just sort of doubled down on sort of our operational efficiency, you know, the dreaded KPIs word, which we were pretty focused around having meaningful KPIs, not just KPIs for KPIs' sake, but having meaningful KPIs and getting people to buy into those KPIs and really own those KPIs. That, you know, that was driven more. We needed more out of people. So, you know, ratios.
Yeah.
Everyone's ratios were a bit skewed because obviously they had to do more business development calls to generate jobs. They had to have more Teams meetings to generate jobs. You know, it was a case of having to reset the minds to go, okay, this is the situation, guys. You're either in with us or you're not. And if you are in with us, this is what we need from you. And this is what we will do to support you if you do show this. So I think that was where, you know, you look at you look at it and you go, okay, these people are trying their best and they're going for it. So how can we support them to get through that? And we've had some good examples of people being promoted very recently where, you know, they've stuck at it and they've probably improved as recruiters, because I think it's very difficult if you have a recruitment career to not go through a challenging period of time.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think you learn a lot about yourself. And if you can get through that and come out the other side, you'll be a lot better for it.
100%. Do you regard as the most important key performance indicators that you guys have, that you guys have rolled out in the business?
So I think on the permanent side, obviously, you know, permanence, your classic is the amount of, the more people you can get in front of clients interviewing, the better.
Yeah,
I think doubling. So you want to triple down on interviews at client. Yeah, we're big around speed of delivery because mm-hmm. we're very niche and focused. You know, I like people to get jobs boxed off and covered within a sort of a US perm, sort of a week to 2 week period where they're sending like probably 5 or 6 resumes, getting 4 or 5 interviews. That's kind of like the A grade sort of standard that we'd expect. Because that, within 1 to 2 weeks, yeah. I mean, these are going to be sort of mid to senior level roles, so they're not particularly easy. But I think, you know, giving the client enough candidates whereby they can make a decision, or they feel they've seen enough people to make a decision. You know, I think there's nothing worse than having a really good candidate, but then, you know, there's nothing really to sort of compare or back it up with, and then our client procrastinates about making a decision. So we really push that, and then just doubling down and spending time on money making activities, that, you know, not wasting your time with things. You know, that means making sure that you've got good job commitment, you've got process. You know, on contracts, it's about being able to book interviews in without the client seeing the resumes, for example. It's like, right, you want to use us because we're sector experts. You want to bring in a specialist on a contract basis. This is the way I operate. And if they don't want to go with it, then go and find someone else. Whereas before, we probably let the client dictate things a little bit more because maybe the market's a bit better. So, you know, it's a bit easier. But I think it just sharpens the sword around yeah, your processes and the yeah, key performance indicators that you're going after. So, yeah, I think perm, interviews, jobs, client meetings would be the three main ones. There's good cadence from client meetings turning into jobs and then good committed jobs. And then obviously getting those jobs covered in a quick time with good quality candidates and really dialing down on that interview CV to interview ratio. So that was the sort of perm side. And contract was just about that foundation of adding, you know, hiring managers that hire contractors so that the BD was effective. You're not getting, oh, we don't hire contractors. So adding that and then really focusing around, again, client meetings and filling jobs quickly on contract. So, you know, 2 to 3 week turnaround. There is some bit more challenges with our market because a lot of them are international. So there's payroll companies and stuff involved. But that generally was sort of the focus around delivering things.
Love that. That's awesome, Stuart. So you had 2 years like taking off like a rocket. You had a bit of volatility where you had to sharpen the sword, to use your term, and like improve operational efficiencies, get like really strong on BD, make sure that we're focused on the basics, getting good committed jobs, delivering quickly. What's the next phase of growth for you guys? What happens next?
Yeah, no, I think it's going to be an exciting time. So we will finish off our financial year this year at the end of August. So we're
how's
sort
it
of
looking?
I think we're sprinting towards, you know, maintaining probably status quo, I would say, this year.
Okay.
But with less headcount. So
okay,
being more efficient. But what that'll do is give us a really solid base for next year to go again. And I think the opportunity, you know, for people to build their own teams and start really putting that sort of next level of leadership in place is probably where next year sees for us. We also want to open up our Austin office as well and get that moving.
That's exciting. So now we don't have a physical office in the US yet.
Don't have a physical office in the US. We wanted to do it this year. I think now it's going to be delayed till next financial year. But yeah, that's high on the priority. We've got a couple of people internally that want to make the move over there. We've done all the due diligence and everything. So we're kind of ready to go. And also because we have a business that's generating revenue there, all we're really doing, you know, we're adding some additional costs, but all we're doing is putting headcount from the UK into that location with a sprinkling of local talent as well to try and then grow on the, you know, boots on the ground. And I think obviously we'll have at least 30% more time to operate because, you know, there's only so many hours in the day in the UK that, you know, compared to the time difference. So
yes,
we sort of project a 30% increase on what NFI we can generate in Austin versus being based in London. So I think it's fully sort of costed and we know what we're doing there. We just need the right sort of timing. So that should be next year. And I think hopefully the learnings from this year can really propel us forward next year and give us a good solid base to go from.
Stuart, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you for doing it. Let's catch up again. I'd love to hear, you know, how things progress from here. We've heard the first sort of 2.5 year journey, and it is an exciting story. I'd love to catch up again.
Yeah, no, it would be good to see and reflect on.
Maybe we can do an in-person one in Austin.
Yeah, that would be cool. that'd be cool, yeah.
Or if not, London would be the next best thing, right? But
no, that'd be cool. I think hopefully the next time we connect, we should definitely be out there. So
awesome.
Yeah, that would be good.
All right, Stuart. Well, have an awesome weekend. Thanks for doing this.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening to The Resilient Recruiter. I know how busy recruiters are, so I'm honored that you're investing this time with me each week. I don't take your attention for granted. That's why I'm going all out to deliver value for you here, real insights you can apply to improve your business. And if you really want to help me to reach a wider audience and impact more people, please consider leaving the show a review on Apple Podcasts. And if you leave me a review, please reach out and let me know so I can thank you personally. Please hit the subscribe button and I'll see you next time.